Okay, so this is the first lecture, and I'm going to look at the war. And I'm not going to give you a military history of the war. You can find them in the bookshops if you want. I'm going to concentrate on British society and the war, that is to say, what was changed in politics and in social organisation by the war. So let's begin with Chamberlain. This is going back a little bit. He was the Conservative Prime Minister from 1937 to 1940. If I talk too quickly, you'll be able to find it on the web afterwards. So who was he? He was Minister of Health and finally became a Conservative leader and Prime Minister in 1937. Now, 1937, now that you know the tradition is to say good things about people who are dead, and 1937 is not, if you were imagining when you want to be Prime Minister of anywhere, 1937 is not a great time to choose. In 1933, Hitler had become Chancellor of Germany. In 1936, the Spanish Civil War had begun with Franco and his fascists based in the army, the Spanish army in North Africa, invading, and a civil war between the Republicans and the fascists, with most of Europe's governments saying, "Oh, we're not getting involved," except for Hitler and Mussolini. So, troubling time, and slowly in 37, 38, the question of whether it was possible to have a peaceful relationship with Hitler was the big political question of the day. Now, of course, it's very easy for us, because we know what Hitler did next, so it's very easy for us to say, oh, it was, of course, he should have understood earlier that a war was necessary. But of course, at the time, things were not quite so clear. And famously, Chamberlain, and unfortunately for him, I mean, I'm not a great fan of Chamberlain, but it's true that he wasn't very lucky, because he's famous for one thing. He did many things, he's famous for one thing. He's famous for meeting Hitler in 1938 and coming back to England with a piece of paper signed by Hitler. And at the airport, he waved the piece of paper to the journalists and said, "This piece of paper means peace in our time." Okay. So unfortunately, he is famous just for that. That is for believing that Hitler was prepared to keep the peace, because Hitler had signed a piece of paper. As I say, we shouldn't be too hard on him, because it's very easy to be what we call in America a Monday morning quarterback. Monday morning quarterback is the person who on Monday morning knows exactly how the footballers should have played on Saturday. And of course, on Monday morning, it's easy to know what they should have done. So he tried very hard then to avoid the war. Now, why did he try so hard to avoid the war? Now, many leaders of countries do try to avoid wars, because they'd seen the First World War. It wasn't wonderful. But there was also another reason. The elite of Britain was not really convinced that the British people would follow. It was only 20 years since the First World War. And the First World War had been an absolute disaster from the point of view of the population. Was now very unpopular. In the 1920s and the 1930s, the First World War was generally considered to be at best a tragedy and at worst a crime. Yeah, it wasn't popular. Pacifist sentiment was rising. And secondly, the technology had advanced tremendously. In the First World War, the most significant elements of the First World War are machine guns and shells. Now, machine guns and shells are no fun at all. But before this, by the 1930s, there were bombers who could destroy cities. We had never seen mass bombing of cities. So the elite and Chamberlain thought, well, this is a new kind of war, and people might not be able to mobilize the British people for a new war, and that's one of the reasons that he delayed it. In any case, as I'm sure you remember, in 1939 this all fell to pieces, and war was declared on the 3rd of September 1939. The first few months of the war, from a military point of view, were disastrous. I don't remember the details, but so much so that the Prime Minister had to resign. Chamberlain had to resign in May 1940 after the British attacked. The Germans had occupied Norway, and the British attacked the German forces in Norway, and it was a disaster, total failure, and the result was that the government fell. The Chamberlain government fell. So that was the end. That was the end of Chamberlain, and then he was rapidly forgotten. Actually, because for poor bloke. So he was replaced by Winston Churchill, who was a larger than life figure. There is. It's just recently been the anniversary. I think 50 years since the death of Churchill, so there's been a series of documentaries around on the death of Churchill. And of course he is well known. My mother has a little statue, a bust of Churchill on top of her television. Yeah. Now, of course that's funny, but it's also quite significant. You know, how many people here have, in your grandma's house or your mother's house, is there a statue of a politician, any politician? Yeah. De Gaulle? No?
Yeah. Yeah. We have a statue of Napoleon.
Napoleon, okay. Oh, that's even further back, okay. Yeah, yeah. But so you've got Napoleon, but there are not many politicians who are, you know, quelqu'un a un buste d'Edith Cresson? No, je crois pas. Je crois que non. Okay, yeah, so very, very rare, extremely rare. But Winston Churchill was that kind of figure. Okay, so who was Winston Churchill? Well, first of all, he wrote a lot of history books, in fact. And in fact, he was also very funny. And he said, "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." Okay, so this is one of his famous things. And now he was on the other hand, he was the opposite of Chamberlain from the point of view of heritage, because he was very lucky. If Churchill had died in 1938, before the war, he would have been remembered as a failure. What was he famous for? He was famous for organising attacks by the army on strikers in Wales, a long time back. He was famous for organising and inspiring the attack on Turkey at Gallipoli during the First World War, which was an absolute disaster. And in the 1920s, by the end of the 1920s, he didn't have many political friends. He was out in the wilderness. He was not, you know, he was not minister of anything. And he was also well known for liking brandy, a lot of brandy. Yeah? But then, on the other hand, yeah, so if he died in 1938, he would have been forgotten as a failure. But he wasn't, and he did have some two things, I think, which made him memorable. You will, if you haven't noticed, you will notice. I'm not a conservative, and Winston Churchill was a very conservative gentleman. But two things that made him memorable. First of all, he was absolutely convinced that Germany, that the war with Germany was inevitable, and he was in a minority in the 30s. Most people come in. Most people thought that it was possible to manage without it. He was also extremely determined, an exceptionally talented guy, that's for sure. Extremely determined. When he was not a minister of anything, almost every week he wrote a letter to this minister or that minister. This is what I think you should do. This is what I think you should do. Yeah, this was Winston Churchill. He used to put in a puppet la mail. He was a very, very, very confident. And during the war, it's very interesting because there's a point in the war where the ministers are divided, and some of the ministers say, "Oh well, we can't win. We need to negotiate with Hitler." Now, many ministers said this, and Winston Churchill was the side which said no. A certain level of ruthlessness as well. For example, if the German army had invaded Britain, which was completely possible, Winston Churchill had the plans for the British government will move to New York. Yeah, it was not obviously it was a problem, but you know he wasn't. It was a 100% war till the end, and he was also a tremendous speaker. A very, very good speaker. Now this was important in the First World War. If you were a good speaker, that was okay. But in the Second World War, it was very important because of the radio. The radio arrived in the 1930s and transformed politics. And Winston's, Churchill's famous speeches were on the radio, and they certainly helped. So that's the guy. He's also a very, very amusing gentleman. Let's go a little bit more there. Extremely talented. Yes, so in May 1940, for example, one of his major speeches is always called Blood, Sweat and Tears. Blood, Toil, Tears and Sweat. And so what he said to the, this is when he just became Prime Minister, he spoke on the radio or in the House of Parliament or both, and he said, "I have nothing to offer to you but blood, toil, tears and sweat." Yeah. So the idea was, it will be very, very hard, but we will win the war. Now, this was very original. In the First World War, at the beginning of the First World War, the politicians were saying, it is glorious to die for your country. Now, in the 1930s, it was impossible to say, it is glorious to die for your country, because people remembered the First World War, or they remembered what their parents had said. And so, complete change. I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweat. It's a completely different kind of rhetoric, but very, 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 extremely intelligent. Extremely intelligent. Just a couple of stories about Churchill being funny, though. He was a good person to have as a friend and not as an enemy. And here's a couple of stories. Apparently, one lady said to him, "Mr. Churchill, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your coffee." And Winston Churchill said, "Madam, if you were my wife, I would drink it." So it's really quite gone. I just want one more. Another lady says, "Mr. Churchill, you are drunk." "Yes, madam, and you are ugly. But tomorrow morning, I will no longer be drunk." So you can see really the kind of guy who it was better not to cross swords with him in rhetoric. There are many more. You can find some on the web, but I think it is quite good. At the same time, he has become a hero. But he certainly had a very dark sides as well. For example, like many people in the elite at the time, he was absolutely racist. When he writes about Mahatma Gandhi, what he writes about Gandhi in India is it's not a controversy. It is clearly racist. Come in. Please take the documents. That's not a question. Now, many people say, well, at this time, almost all the elite was racist. So you can. There were also anti-racists at this time, but it's true that it was very common in the elite. But I think it's important to remember Winston Churchill believed in the British Empire. Winston Churchill believed that the British Empire was a great step forward for humanity and a tremendous favour which the English were doing to the Africans. And now, this is no longer an opinion which is very common today. So, interestingly, at the end of the First World War, Winston Churchill made another speech, and he said, "If the British Empire lasts 1,000 years, people will still say this was their finest hour." That is to say that he seriously believed that it was possible that the British Empire last 1,000 years. The British Empire lasted 25. Not 100, only 25 more years. Yeah. So he was certainly a good, old-fashioned, traditional imperialist, a real believer in the empire, which obviously was very important. So let's have a little look at the war itself. The Second World War obviously has a tremendous number of myths built up around it. In general, it's very different from the First World War. If you talk about the First World War in Britain today, the general uninformed opinion is, oh, what a terrible waste. It was a bad thing. And when you talk about the Second World War, most people consider, I'm not saying whether they're right or wrong, most people consider that it was bad but necessary. Yeah, whereas the First World War has an image of being bad and unnecessary, and the Second World War has an image of being bad but necessary. It's difficult to know exactly what the war was about. It obviously was not a war for democracy, because, for example, India joined the war because London decided. There was nobody in India had any possibility to decide. It was obviously not a war to defend Poland, because Poland was given to Stalin at the end of the war. As a war against fascism, it's a little bit shaky, because Salazar, the fascist dictator in Portugal, was an ally, and the fascist Franco remained in power after the war. Nevertheless, it's certainly true that for the millions of people involved in the Second World War, I'm talking especially about British people, anti-fascism was very important. Yeah, that was one of the important motivations that keep them going. Okay, I'm going to move on to the home front. What happened then in Britain itself? The first period of the war is known in English and French as the Phony War. The first few months of the war is known in French as the Drôle de Guerre, and in English as the Phony War. That is to say, nobody attacked anybody, nothing happened. And everybody was preparing. And I was saying to you that I'm not going to give you a military history of the war, I'm going to talk about what happened in Britain. So let's have a look at the home front. Now, the home front is possibly not the right expression, on en français, le front intérieur, but it suggests, if you use the expression the home front, that suggests that the only important thing about what happened in Britain is how it contributed to the war. But in fact, people continue their lives and they adapt to the war, but the war is not their only priority. So certainly in the population, there were many activities to either avoid the war or profit from the war. Because Britain won the war, there has been a tremendous heroic myth about the Second World War, how everybody was together against the bombings, etc. Of course, this is completely untrue. You don't get situations where everybody is together. You get some people, you get many people together, and there's always some people trying to profit. For example, if you wanted to rent a house, the terrible thing about the Second World War is the bombing. The bombings, even more in France, but tremendous bombings in Britain. In the outer suburbs, the rents went up very, very high, because the people who owned houses in the outer suburbs said, I can make some money now. Normally, you have to pay £100 a month for my flat. But, you know, because there's bombing everywhere, everybody wants it, so it's £200, yeah? There were plenty of people profiting as well, which is important not to idealize. So what happened? Well, first of all, they tried to make the bombing less effective. The first thing is what you call barrage balloons. These are big hot air balloons which make life difficult for aeroplanes. And so the aeroplanes must fly higher, and when aeroplanes fly higher, their bombing is not so accurate. That's one thing. The second thing is that people were really convinced that gas, poison gas, would be an important element of the Second World War. Poison gas was used in the First World War, by all sides, in the trenches, and people were very worried about the gas, and so they produced 38 million gas masks for the civilian population, yes, the things you put on your head. And so when my mother was 6 years old, and they all had to go to school with their gas mask under their arm, yeah, so which are all these terrified children. And in fact, for reasons which we don't really understand, there was no gas used. Nobody used gas. This was a massive mobilization. If you wanted to go to the cinema, and if you didn't have your gas mask, they would not allow you into the cinema. I used the cinema as an example because the cinema was massive at the time, before television. The cinema was absolutely massively popular. It was not unusual to go to the cinema three times a week. Today it's too expensive to go three times a week. They also had tremendous social changes with evacuation. Now, of course, most of the bombings happened in the cities: Manchester, Liverpool, London, Coventry. These were the places that were bombed. And so they declared in September that all the children must leave the towns. Yeah. And 827,000 children and 500,000 pregnant mothers were evacuated from the towns. So this was an enormous change for people. Now, of course, some people could send their children to an auntie who lived in the countryside. But remember, this is Britain, not France. Nobody lives in the countryside in Britain. It's empty. There isn't much, anyway, for a start. It's true that the idea of j'ai de la famille qui habite à la campagne is something really French, but in England I don't know anybody who knows people who live in the country. I suppose people must live there. I don't know, I've never been there. So mostly the children were taken to strangers' houses. That is to say, it was literally the case, it was in the newspaper, Saturday morning, bring your children to Manchester railway station and we will take them away. And they took them away in a bus. They arrive in a village, knock on the door. Hello, how many rooms do you have? Six. How many people live here? Five. Here are three children. Next time. And you didn't have a choice, of course, this is war. Very, very interesting social changes for people. First of all, remember, these children normally did not travel. They didn't go anywhere. They maybe went for a weekend to the sea. Once every 2 years. Yes, very poor people. And secondly, the people who lived in the towns were the working class. And the people in the villages who had an extra room were not rich, but they were middle class people. And so you got a tremendous social mixing. And many middle class people were very shocked at how poor the children who arrived. You know, oh, they don't have shoes. Where are your shoes? I don't have any shoes. Yeah. That kind of situation. So it was a very important social experience. There were also some tragedies, actually. Remember, at this time, people have big families. Six, seven, eight children. And there are not a few cases where, at the end of the war, the children... It sounds funny, but it mustn't have been funny for the people. The children came back to the towns, and they couldn't find their parents because their parents had moved. And some of them never found their parents. Which is, you know, this is being studied. We don't know exactly what happened, but certainly some poor parents said, "Oh, my children have been taken by somebody who has money in the countryside. It's better for my children if I don't take them back." Yeah, you get all these kind of calculations going on. So the social effect, of course, the reason for the evacuation was the war, but the effect of the evacuation was much bigger. There was also on the 1st of January 1940, 2 million men aged between 20 and 27 were conscripted to join the armed forces. So the elite had learned from the First World War. In the First World War, in 1914 and 1915, there were only volunteers in the British Army, only volunteers, no conscripts, no obligation. At the beginning of the First World War, the whole of the elite, the Conservatives and the Liberals, were against conscription. They said it's not British. But in the Second World War, they immediately moved to conscription for a number of reasons, but certainly partly because I think it's fair to say it was impossible to win the Second World War with a volunteer army. Modern war of this period was total war. The whole of the economy needed to be mobilized. This was not understood in the First World War. It took a long time for the British government in the First World War to mobilize the whole entire economy, because they didn't understand that total war is total war. They also immediately introduced rationing. So rationing is very simple. One of the problems, of course, when you have a war is there's not enough food, because the meat which comes from Argentina cannot get past the German submarines. It's not complicated, yeah? Remember that Britain is an industrial country, not an agricultural country, so depends on importing food. Now, there are two ways of dealing with this. If the government does nothing, meat becomes very expensive and only rich people can buy it. And so what they do is they introduce rationing. Rationing is very simple. Every individual has a card, and you are allowed to buy 200 grams of meat every week, and that's all. Even if you are very, very rich, in theory, you're only allowed to legally buy 200 grams of meat every week. And that's not an exaggeration, that was approximately the amount of the rationing. So now, rationing, although of course it can be quite hard, rationing is a democratic measure. It means that everybody will have some meat. If there is no rationing, then the prices go through the roof. Very different from the First World War. In the First World War, rationing was only introduced in the last year of the war in 1918. So here are some of the big changes. The beginning of the war, difficult for the British. The famous case of Dunkirk, in French, of course. Dunkerque, on the other Dunkirk. And in Dunkirk, the British army was isolated and surrounded, and they were very lucky, for some reason which we don't understand, they managed to escape. In fact, 300,000 soldiers left France on small boats, many, many small boats. Whereas normally, for some reason we don't really, I don't really understand, the Germans could have destroyed the place, you know, but they didn't manage to do it. Maybe they had bad information and so on. And just after that, France, under Maréchal Pétain, signed the armistice with Hitler. So the situation from a military point of view is looking very bad. First of all, the British army has run away, and this is not just a political problem, it's also a military problem, because if you're leaving in a hurry, all the British tanks, all the British guns stayed in Dunkirk. Now, of course, what did they do first before they left? They destroyed the guns. Yeah, if you're running away, you don't leave the guns. Oh, here's a present for Hitler. No? Yeah, so they destroyed hundreds and thousands of tanks and guns were destroyed by the British army before they disappeared. So from a military point of view, things were looking very, very bad. And at this point, there was a division in the government. Some people said, we can't win. We have to surrender. Yeah, we have to surrender. We have to negotiate. We don't like Hitler, but, you know, what can you do? We're losing. The Americans are not interested. This is how it appeared in 1940. And we have no equipment. We have no tanks, etc. So, big crisis in the government, also difficult international negotiations. In India, one of the Indian leaders, Nehru, said to the British government, we will send a lot more Indian soldiers if you give India independence. And the British government, no, we're not giving India independence, no. Division, and the British government, against Churchill's opinion, wrote a letter to Hitler. Says, "What are your terms for peace? You know, what are your conditions for peace?" But the peace deal did not happen, and Churchill was certainly always opposed to it. The American government intervened here with the Lend-Lease Act. The Lend-Lease Act is a law passed in the American Congress in 1941, which, from a financial point of view, is quite complicated. But the most important thing is, we will lend a lot of money to Britain. Yeah? And so they loaned an enormous amount of money to Britain. And Britain became completely dependent on America's financial aid. From a military point of view, then there was a long period where not much happened. It was very, very difficult. Hitler was not able to invade Britain, fundamentally because the technology of British aeroplanes was better. The radar was better. And so the British Air Force managed to stop the bombing of Britain after 1941. The bombing of Britain did not continue for the whole war. It only continued for one part of it. But the war was in an impasse, and the impasse was solved in the same way as the impasse with Napoleon was solved 150 years earlier. That is that Hitler decided to invade Russia, and If you're ever a big dictator in Europe, don't invade Russia. It doesn't work. It's a really bad idea. Yeah? It's too big. Yeah? And so that was eventually the downfall of Russia. Now, the British myth about the war is very interesting, because if you watch British war films, if you watch British films about the Second World War, the most popular films, then you can see that in the films, the Russians do nothing. The Russians do nothing. The French resistance does not exist. The Americans arrive too late. And only the British are the heroes against the Germans. Just all of which goes to show that a fictional film is a fictional film. Yeah. It's a bit like war films about the Vietnam War. Yeah. One American director said recently, "I would like to make a film about the Vietnam War in which the Vietnamese win, because they did win, you know." That is, most of the American films about the Vietnam War do not show the Vietnamese winning; they just show how terrible it is for American soldiers. Yeah? So back to the British. That's the case. Okay. So just before, however, before they managed to stop the German aircraft, you have a period of the war called the Blitz, which has also become a myth. Remember, when I say that something is a myth, that doesn't mean it's not true. From a historical point of view, when we say something is a myth, it means its symbolic importance is much more important than what really happened. So it's a myth. So it's certainly true that many people had a tremendous experience of solidarity during the Blitz, the bombing. However, it has become today, you know, the atmosphere, the spirit of the Blitz has become a symbol of all British people together, yeah, repeating the same slogan. That's later. Okay, so the home front and the Blitz. So the Blitz is when the Germans are bombing. Very strict rules. There must be no light. You've got these aircraft, yeah? And if they see lights, that's where they bomb. And so very, very strict blackout. That is to say, you had to cover all your windows at night. And there were amateur policemen coming round and knocking on your door and in the middle of the night if they could see some light. There was a lot of fire. Enormous amount of fire, so staying up fire watching was very common. Enormous numbers of volunteers. In Britain during the war, people didn't sleep. Very, very difficult to sleep between the bombing, two nights a week you're fire watching, and working very long hours, because remember that total war is economic war. The country which wins is the country which can create, which can fabricate the largest number of guns, bullets, uniforms, food, etc. There's also an interesting phenomenon of trekking. Pardon, le sens moderne. Trekking is very simple. If you lived in Manchester, where it is bombed, you would work during the day, and in the evening, as soon as you could, you start walking, and you walk out into the countryside to sleep, because there's no bombs out there. And people would walk, you know, 10 miles and then walk back 10 miles in the morning. The government didn't like this. The bombing was very different from what people thought. In the 1930s and the 1920s, the government had ordered a lot of reports to try to understand what would happen if there was mass bombing of the cities. And they considered that many, many people would go completely mad. They were prepared for people for hundreds of thousands of people to be psychologically broken. And in fact, this was not the case. Of course, there were some people, but that was not the case. You didn't get mass panic. Now, enormous amount of queuing and a certain amount of conflict with the elite. You must not think that because there is a war, there was no more conflict between the classes. For example, if you live in London and there is bombing, of course, the place you would want to hide would be in the underground. Yeah, it's an obvious place. The government refused to allow people to hide in the underground. They closed all the underground stations. You weren't allowed in. Now, why was this? Well, the reason was the governments were convinced that if people went down into the underground, they would not come If they would not come out. They would just stay there because the bombing was so scary. And they thought it would be very bad for morale. Now, however, a big campaign with trade unionists and left-wing people, organized, quite often organized by the Communist Party, obliged the government to open the underground, so it was then possible to work in the underground, to sleep in the underground. And a couple of hundred thousand people slept in the underground. The bombing was absolutely tremendous. 90% of buildings in London were damaged. Yeah, 90%, yeah, absolutely enormous amount of damage. Now, bombing had been very unpopular in the 20s. Many people had said, okay, well, war is sometimes necessary, but bombing cities is immoral. But during the Second World War, this was not the case. And in fact, from a political point of view, the government tried to make the bombing popular. And so, for example, they would have announcements in the morning saying, last night we sent 1,000 bombers to Berlin. Yeah. So it was a very interesting political idea to try to popularize it in this way. 51,000 civilians were killed by bombs in Britain. This is lower than the number of British pilots killed bombing Germany. And the number of Germans killed by British bombs is much, much higher, maybe even 10 times as high. One of the reasons for this is, like I say, the superior technology of British aeroplanes meant that after a few months, they could stop the German aeroplanes arriving. Whereas Germany is big, and you can come from any side, and it was much more difficult to defend. So far more people were killed in Germany. The symbolic places of the bombing campaigns in the two countries are Coventry. Coventry is an industrial town in the middle of England, which was really just completely destroyed. And today, if you go to Coventry, there is Coventry Cathedral, and the cathedral was half destroyed. Half of it is down, and the other half they have kept in the same situation. They didn't rebuild it, and they made it a monument to peace. And in Germany, Dresden was a beautiful old city. And today, everything in Dresden is new. Well, new, 1950s. Somebody else trying to get in? Okay, take the, okay, thank you. Oui, prenez des trucs. Oui, c'est un peu exceptionnel aujourd'hui. Okay. I'm going to have to move forward a little bit here. So... There is a tremendous effect on society of the war, and not just the military side of it. And in fact, I'm most interested in the social side of it. The trade unions during the war became very popular. In 1939, there were 6 million members of trade unions, and in 1945, there were eight million members of trade unions. This is a very important rise, in particular because there were 5 million men in the army, and of course, if you're in the army, you're not allowed to join a trade union. So the trade unions were very important. And also wages rose. The government really needed people to work very hard. And so wages rose. And strangely enough, which is during the Second World War, if you were not killed, you probably had a better life. You probably had more money for working class people than before the war. During the war, there were strikes were banned. And the trade unions were involved in organising production. Perhaps the most important social fact of the war is that there was no unemployment. Remember, well, perhaps you do remember, but during the 1930s, enormous unemployment, and unemployment was a terrible, terrible thing for millions of people. During the war, zero unemployment. They needed every worker. And when there is zero unemployment, wages rise, because you know, because the bosses the bosses needed you. There were also some changes in the rules about walking around in Britain. For example, the British, everybody in Britain had to have an identity card. Now, you don't find this very shocking, but British people do. The only time there has been a national identity card in Britain is during the war. And even today, when I say to my English friends, oh, in France, everybody must have an identity card. And my English friend says, oh, yeah, fascist country, okay. That is not, they're not joking. They're not joking. That carrying an identity card is just, I have great difficulty carrying identity, and I've been lived in France for 25 years. Yeah. I think it's a sort of natural sort of anarchism in the English, that the English says, here I am, here is a policeman. Yeah. The policeman doesn't know who I am. This is not my problem. Yeah. If he wants to know who I am, he can ask me. And so it's interesting that even today, with all the terrorism thingy, it is politically impossible to institute an identity card in Britain. People there. They tried 10 years ago or 15 years ago, they tried to introduce an identity card, but they tried to introduce it little by little. So first of all, they said, there is an identity card, but it's not obligatory, an identity card for people who want one. They didn't fight. I mean, they found some very bizarre people who wanted one. You know, oh yeah, what I really want is an identity card. But it wasn't successful. So there was, during the war, there was a national identity card. There was also, very important, the utility. The utility campaign. Now, what is the utility campaign? I was saying a moment ago that the most important aspect of modern 20th century total war is the economic aspect. That is, that the strongest economy wins. Of course, you have some heroes and some idiots, like in every country, and the strongest economy wins. This is why when America intervened in the First and the Second World War, that was the end of the story. They had so many more ships and tanks and guns and uniforms and soldiers that was the end of the doubts about who was going to win the war. But the government tried very hard to organise the economy so that the war was the only priority. Total mobilisation for war. And one of the ways they did this is they said, well, let's have a look at the clothes shops. Oh, look, there are 100, well, look at the clothes shops in Paris today. There are 700 different coats you can buy, or 7,000. And they said, well, this is very, very wasteful. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask expert designers to design 5 winter coats for women, only 5. And this we will save a lot of money in this way, and the economy can concentrate on the war. And so this was utility. It was illegal to produce many different kinds of clothes. It was only legal to produce a small choice of clothes, utility clothes. Utility furniture as well. It says, okay, here are 5 kinds of tables. British factories will only produce these 5 tables. And this saves a lot of money, perhaps you can imagine. So utility clothes, utility furniture, and the prices of furniture were established. Now, this was a quite interesting event from the point of view of fashion, because they asked the best designers in the country, they said, oh, this is a war, it is your patriotic duty to design clothes for the masses. So that was a sort of interesting idea. Rationing, in fact, was extremely popular because people realised that if there was no rationing, the war also transformed health care. In the 1930s, many, many people, millions of people, could not afford to go to see a doctor. And there was a lot of unemployment, so, you know, let's say it wasn't a priority for the elites. But during the war, they needed every adult to be in good health, to go to work. If you're going to win the war, you need a healthy population. And so medical progress was very high. For example, the old favourite, penicillin, which I think it was a couple of French scientists who discovered it. But penicillin was discovered, I can't remember when, long before the Second World War. But it was not used because it was a little bit expensive, and you know, it wasn't used for poor people. And during the war, everybody got penicillin, the first antibiotics. Yeah. So in fact, the war made healthcare much better. In Britain, it also made considerable amounts, considerable improvements in social justice. They introduced high income tax on rich people. In the 1930s, you know, it was quite low. During the war, the tax for richer people was very high. There was also, of course, tremendous transformations in women's lives. In 1939. 500,000 women were working full-time. 500,000 women in 1939 worked full-time. In 1945, 7 million. Yeah, so the number of women working full-time, it was very typical to work part-time, yeah. The number of women working full-time was more than 7 million.